Okay, you'll notice on your schedule that it says two maestros. And I explain why I chose that term every year. I like the word maestro. And where I saw it was in a movie from Argentina called Tango. And down there, the tango is top tango dancers like our star quarterback here. And there's a scene in a nightclub where they interrupt all the music and the owner of the club announces that they have a maestro there to demonstrate the tango. And the Argentine tango is a very complicated dance. It takes a lifetime to really learn it. And he makes it look effortless. He makes it look so simple. And after you've been around AA for a while, you find that you do reduce life to its simplest terms. And our two guests tonight who volunteered to share for 25 minutes each, to me, capture this. Just the simplicity of the energy in living and presenting the message. And the first one is a gentleman I've known for 25 years up in Washington, D.C. We're fellow Marines. And he's been a delight. I was there at his first meeting, and he's been a delight to watch. I just love what's happened to him. And he agreed to share whatever comes out this evening. And let's welcome Bill Peterson from Washington, D.C.
Maestro is an ancient Anglo-Saxon word for bullshitter. My name is Bill Peterson. I'm an alcoholic. Sandy and I, the Marine Corps in its wisdom sent Sandy and me to Japan sometime after the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was stationed down south. I was stationed up north. We never met. Good thing. They'd have buried my remains at the foot of Mount Fuji if we had met. Or perhaps more appropriately, scattered my ashes over the Tiger Bar in Yokohama. I'll just say this. When I hit Japan in the Marine Corps, my alcoholism went into double afterburner. Boom, boom. And when I left in 64, it kept going for another 22 years until I flamed out. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic. Now, I've been making my living as a news broadcaster for over 40 years, and I can bullshit on almost anything. But I don't know much about spirituality, and I don't want to bullshit on that. I'm just going to tell you my experience, and you just take it for what it is. I saw a book the other day by Kerry Kennedy. It's a series of little personal profiles called Catholics Now. And people talk about their Catholic youth and so forth. And I thought it was kind of interesting. And I was, you know, obviously they answered a set of questions. And I thought if somebody had asked me to do that, you know, where would I begin? And I tried to go back and I realized something. I couldn't remember my first communion. And in the Catholic tradition, this is very important, First Communion. It begins at the age of 7, supposedly the age of reason, where you know right from wrong. And the little boys dress up in white suits and white shirts and white ties, and little girls dress up like little brides, and everybody celebrates, and it's a big thing. But I can't remember it. I have no memory of it at all. What I do remember is my first confession. I remember that. I remember that very clearly. You go into this dark place behind a heavy velvet curtain. Light opens, and a voice says, "Yes, begin." And you say, "Bless me, Father, for I've sinned." And he says, "How long since your last confession?" I said, "This is my first confession, Father." He said, and what are your sins?" I said, "I committed adultery 7 times. He said, "You what?" "I committed adultery 7 times. He said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 7, Father." He said, "Adultery is a grown-up sin." All right, let me help you. We sin in thought, word, or deed. Was this thought, word, or deed? "Word, Father." "Well, tell me about it." "Well, I don't think I should. Tell me about it." "Well, I called Freddie Farkas a shithead 7 times. And he said, "Well, you know, that's a vulgarity. That's not, but you shouldn't be saying bad things about Freddie." "Why are you saying bad things?" I said, "Because he beats me up all the time." He said, "Well, it's not really, you know, you're okay. And we went through other things. Did you disobey your parents? Were you disrespectful and so forth? Say 3 Our Fathers, 3 Hail Marys, a good act of contrition. Oh my," and then you have to get a running start on these prayers or you flame out in the middle. And so that was it. But the interesting thing about this, I don't remember my first communion is supposed to be your first conscious contact with your higher power, with your God. And I don't remember that. I remember the separation. I remember the sin part, but I don't remember the communion part. It's interesting. And when I was a kid, I hated alcohol. I hated what it did to people. And I always said to myself, "I'm never going to do this to myself. No child of mine is ever going to witness this kind of behavior." And I kept that promise. I mean, I didn't drink in high school, and I didn't drink through the freshman year of college. And I had a lot of friends. And I was popular. I was elected class office type year after year after year. And I felt totally alone, isolated. Felt like I didn't fit in. My parts didn't mesh with other people's parts, despite all the friends and all the popularity. I felt a sort of anxiety all the time. There was a little guy in my gut with sharp knives who was kind of grinding away all the time. So I never discussed this with anybody because I never let anybody get close enough to me to hear this. And anyway, as I say, I didn't drink through my freshman year of college. And then I decided, Sandy mentioned religious orders. I joined one after my freshman year of college, an ancient one, founded in the early 13th century, semi-cloistered, monastic order. They call themselves friars. And they had a lot of rules, and I didn't agree with any of the rules. I didn't take any vows, but they work you toward vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. I didn't have any problem with poverty because I was a child of the Depression and nobody had any money anyway. Obedience was a real problem for me. There were things they wanted me to do and I just didn't want to do them. They didn't want us to smoke. I smoked. I managed to find cigarettes. The novice master and I didn't get along. I thought he was a very unreasonable guy. They wanted me to change. And I didn't want to change. I liked the way I was. Just the way it was. I thought it was fine. I thought they were screwed up. I thought they were yesterday's men. Chastity? Well, I didn't agree with the dating policy, okay? These monks in these ancient orders, they face each other in these priories or monasteries, and then the altar's up here. And out here, the faithful come when they come to Mass. And on Sundays, the local sheriff would bring his daughters in. And the daughters were built like brick cathedrals. And I started to notice on Sundays I was more focused on the sheriff's daughters than I was on what was going on the altar. And I thought, this is telling me something. So I decided this life isn't for me. But I will say I did start to drink in there, and I figured if anybody's got a right to drink, it's a guy like me in a place like this who is so misunderstood. So that's where I started drinking, because I was being misunderstood, and they were trying to change. So I left, I finished college, and then I enlisted in the Marine Corps. And then they started telling me what to do. And I, quite frankly, I didn't like taking orders there either. But in the monastery, if you don't take orders, they just give you some penance or something. In the Marine Corps, if you don't take orders, they lock your ass up. So, you know, I had to live with it. But I started drinking, and it got, as I said earlier, it got pretty serious. I got out, and I managed to get out without any disciplinary proceedings, miraculously. And I decided I wanted to be a broadcast journalist. I had no training, I had no schooling, I had no experience, and I bullshit my way into that job, which I've been doing ever since. And I've never had a real job. I was 71 last Friday, and the way I'm going, it looks like I'll never have to have one. So I'm still doing the same thing. When alcoholism is your master, you don't do the job you could probably do to the best of your ability. I got married, not a good husband, had two beautiful children whom I love more than anything on the face of the earth, but it didn't keep me away from a drink, my feelings for them. By the way, I want to go back to this early religious training. I never felt connected. I really never felt connected to a higher power or to God or anything like that, except once, I remember. My father was in a lot of trouble. I love my father. Of course, I never let him know that, because I never let anybody know how I felt about him. After he died, I remember I went into the bathroom, cried hot tears, looked in the mirror and said, "You never told him how much you love him." That was my life. But he was in some trouble. And so I started going to Mass and communion every day for, I don't know, a couple of months. And I did. I felt I was praying for him. I was asking God to take care of him. And I felt a connection there, you know. And then things worked out for him. That's it. I stopped going. And the connection disappeared. In any case, I got married. Situation was not good. I was a bad husband, not a good father. Bad employee, but I got away with it. And then one night in February, in the 80s, I had a short, intense, inspirational conversation with a policeman from Montgomery County, Maryland. And he was in a driving snowstorm. And I grew up in New England. I love to drive in snow. But the guy pulled me over and we started all this stuff. And I said, what'd you pull me over for? He said, well, you were going like this. I said, look out there. Everybody's going like that. There are ruts in the snow. And he said, where do you live? I said, right over there. That's the roof of my house, right over there. He said, get in the house and stay there till morning. I said, you know, I really like cops. I don't think you get the respect you deserve. I think you get a bad. He said, never mind the bullshit. Just get in the car and don't come out till you see blue sky and sunshine. So I went to the house and talked to my then wife, and she had been going to out to a treatment center for a couple of years, telling everybody what a great husband she had. And I said, I think I ought to go talk to that guy you've been talking to. So I went out there the next morning, got all dressed up, blue suit, white shirt, tie, shine shoes. And the place was run by a psychiatrist, MD, and a recovering alcoholic, former Navy guy. And the MD breathalyzed me. He said, when did you have your last drink? I said, I don't know, about 6 o'clock last night. It's now about noontime. He said, that's 18 hours. I said, yeah. He said, you've got enough. The alcohol in your system right now is life-threatening. Right now, 18 hours after your last drink. And I had this great feeling of pride and elation. I said, all right. You got a real man now, all right? Yeah? So I figured I'd stick around and listen to these guys until I heard some lies. It was an 18-month program. I stayed for 22 months. I'd been there, a week, and I got a call from a reporter friend of mine. He said, I understand you're undergoing treatment for alcoholism. Good luck to you. I said, where'd you hear that? She said, from so-and-so. It's another person in the program, same place. They have signs all over the place respecting your anonymity and all that. So I got very upset, very upset. They said, I hope you're not going to leave because of this. Well, I'm very upset. So I started complaining about it in one of the group therapy sessions. During a break, this very nice young woman came up to me and she said, I don't know who you are. To me, you're just another fucking drunk. And that's when I learned that God used the F word, because that's all I am. When I told you I'm an alcoholic, we were strangers yesterday, but you know me today better than 90% of the people who've known me my whole life. As soon as I say that to you, you know who I am. And when I hear you say that, I know who you are. I've got your number and you got my number. So I decided, well, I better get into AA. So I called this woman I knew who was in recovery, and she said, I got a good meeting for you. It's over at Sibley Hospital in Washington, D.C. And as a Marine like you running the thing, and I think you'll like it. So I go in, and the place is packed. And I sit next to this very elegant woman, and this Marine fighter pilot is up there. Sandy B is his name. And he's raffling off potted mums. This is how he starts. He's raffling out pot. So the woman next to me said, I used to be one of those. I said, one of what? She said, a potted mum. Jesus. All right, that's okay. So he starts to talk, and I'm thinking, he's been talking to the guys out at the treatment center. He knows about me. He's got my number. He's talking about my life. So I listen, and at the end of the meeting, we all hold hands, we say the Lord's Prayer. I find myself weeping. And I realize I'm a guy who never felt he belonged anywhere, never felt at home. For the first time in my life, I feel at home. I feel like I belong somewhere. In the past, whenever I'm somewhere, I want to be somewhere else. I'm in this room, and I think, this is right where I belong. I'm at home at last. It's a staggering thought. So I walk out, and I'm suddenly surrounded by thugs. Bunch of guys. I don't know who the hell they are. Said, Tuesday morning up at the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, in room such and such, there's a meeting. It's called the Yays and Nays. Be there. It starts at 8 or 8:15. I said, I can't. I work nights. Guy said, do you have an alarm clock? I said, yeah, I have an alarm. You set the alarm. I said, look, when you're going to bed, I'm going to work, 11 p.m. He said, you have a bed? I said, yeah, I have a bed. He said, take a nap. So these were not suggestions. These were demands. So I went up there, and I'm walking up the hill. It's a beautiful day, and I noticed for the first time ever, I see this beautiful Capitol Dome in focus. And I thought, this is a plus. I walk through the door. A guy comes up, and he says, hi, my name is Bob. What's yours? I said, my name is Bill. He said, how much time do you have, Bill? I said, what do you mean? He said, how long have you been sober? How long since you had your last drink? I said, I don't know, I guess 2 weeks. He said, congratulations. You've got more sobriety than 99% of the alcoholics in the world. So I sit down, and, you know, the meeting's going. I introduce myself to the guy next to me. He looks like a bulldog. His name's Jeremiah. Like this. In the middle of the meeting, he says, Willie, bullshit's all right unless you believe your own. Every time I went up there for a month, that's what he said to me. He knew something about me. So I kept coming back, and every time I come back, I bump into Bob. The week later, Bob says, congratulations, Bill, you got 21 days. Week after that, congratulations, Bill, you got 28 days. This goes on and on. And after 6 months, he hands me this little blue chip from East Moline, Illinois, and it says 6 months on it. And he kept giving me these chips, and suddenly other people started giving me these chips. And I began to get it. I'd been about 4 months since I'd had a drink, and I was at the Saturday Morning Live meeting, Sandy's meeting, and I see a guy I used to work with, and he doesn't look good. He's got 3 days' growth of beard, and he's got food all over his T-shirt, and I start to speak to him. He's out of focus. And I noticed after the meeting, he jumps on this little white bus. So I say to somebody, what's the white bus? He said, that's the PI bus, Psychiatric Institute bus. It's a treatment place down on K Street in Washington. It was like a prison. Sandy used to go down there every Wednesday and run a meeting. I knew that. So I jump on the bus, and I say, hey, I'll see you Wednesday night. The bus driver said, I'll tell him. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing right now. Well, by the time I get down there Wednesday, he was all cleaned up, and he looked pretty good. And he'd have a sponsor. How about being my sponsor? I said, you're out of your mind. I said, I got 4 months. I'm a rookie. And there was one of the guys who worked there was walking by, and he said, "Say yes." So I run over to Sandy, and I say, "This guy wants me to sponsor him. I barely read the big book." He says, "I'll help you with it." So I start to sponsor. Well, we sponsor each other, basically, and we've been doing it ever since. Here's how this thing works. I get a call. This is a guy who traveled a lot. I get a call from the Philippines. He says, I'm in real trouble." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "I'm in my room in this 5-star hotel, and there's a bar in the room. There's every kind of liquor you can think of, and I can't stop looking at it." Now, there's like 13 hours difference, so, you know, these calls are taking place at weird times. So I said, "Hey, go in the bathroom, get a towel, put it over the booze." So he calls me back about an hour later. He says, "It's not working. I keep thinking what's under the towel." So I said, "Go for a walk." He calls me back. I went for the walk, but is this? I can't. So I said, "Go get, take a cold shower." So he gets. I still keep thinking what's under the towel. I said, "Go for another walk." He goes for another walk. He said, "I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. I'll keep walking all night. I'll call you back." He called me back about an hour later. He said, "I figured it out." I said, "What'd you do?" He said, "I called the front desk. I told him to take the booze out of the room." This is over about a 6-hour period. So this guy and I are like two drunks trying to get across the street, right? For over 2 decades. That's how we're living our lives, you know. So that part of it works. But my marriage, it was breaking up, and it was rough, and just rough. And I had this noise in my head, and I couldn't get the noise out of my head, and it was just awful. And I was going to meetings, and I was talking to Sandy, and I was guilty about my kids. And every day he would say to me, hey, before you hang up, I got a message for you. You're a great father. Every night. But I didn't believe it. Anyway, I got this terrible moment, and finally, I couldn't take it anymore. I jumped in the car, and I drove down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. I checked into a crummy motel, and I started walking the beach. I walked for hours. I came back. I was exhausted, really, really, really in despair, just as bad as I've ever felt emotionally. I didn't know what the hell to do. I finally knelt down by the bed, and I started to pray the way the nuns had taught me to pray when I was a little boy. Our Father, Hail Mary, glory be to the Father, all this time. And this darkness started to lift a little bit. I just prayed some more, and then it lifted a little bit. Then I prayed some more, and it sort of disappeared. And I had this feeling of lightness. So I ran to this crummy motel. There were no cell phones, didn't have a phone in the room. So I go to pay phone. I called this woman who had been telling me to pray. Huh. And I tell her what happened. She said, "Well, you're having a spiritual awakening." So I needed a second opinion. So I called Sandy. He said, "This could be the beginning of a spiritual awakening." So I said, "Well, if I want to stay alive, if I want to stay sober, I have to pray. That's what I have to do. I have to keep praying." And so that's what I do. I pray every day. I pray for people I love. I pray for people who piss me off. That pisses me off, but I do it. I pray for people who are sick. I pray for strangers I've met who have problems. I have a long list. I do it. I'm not a theologian. I'm just a drunk. I don't know who I'm talking to, okay? And I do other things. I mean, if I have an issue, if I'm about to go into something that I think is difficult, I say, "Give me a hand with this, will you? Or help me with this. Show me the way." I don't know who I'm talking to. Now, you want to put a name on that? Go ahead. Call it God. Call it the Great Spirit. Call it the Great Reality. Call it the Universal Truth. I don't care what you call it. You know, call it Clint Eastwood's great grandmother. I don't care what you call it. I'm just telling you, I do this because I can't not do it and stay sober. I can't do it. It's the only way I can stay connected to whatever that is. And I was in a meeting in New York City, and they have great meetings there, about a month ago, and there was a young woman there, was in tough shape. She had she had 3 days. Talking about it, and a sister had come down from Boston to help her. The sister had about 3 years of sobriety, and I thought, boy, I wish I could do something for this kid. So I talked to Clint Eastwood's grandmother. You know, I said, give me a hand with this, will you? And after the meeting, I went up to her and I said, can I ask you to do something for me? And she said, if I can. I said, can you pray? She said, yes, yes, I can. I said, would you ask God to keep me away from a drink today? She said, yes, I will. I said, okay, and I'm going to do the same thing for you. And if we do this, I think we're going to get through the day okay. And she said, okay. I haven't seen this woman since, but she's on my list, top of my list. Pray for her every night. I don't know whether she's sober or not, but she's keeping me sober. And she's keeping me close to this thing, this power, whatever it is that we're talking about today, she's keeping me there. She and all the other people on my list. And it's worked so far. I've got more than 2 decades around you guys. A couple of years before I had the nice conversation with the policeman, I came out of a blackout on a wet bathroom floor, cold, smelly, shaking, pulse was pounding, and I thought I was going to die. And it's not the first time that happened to me. I came to in motel rooms with chambermaids saying, are you okay? You want me to call a doctor? No idea how I got there, that kind of thing. We all know that. You all know that story. But this time I said, please, God, don't let me die this way. Let me die with some dignity. It took a couple of years to get the answer to that prayer, to that plea. But the answer was this. This is not about your death. This is about your life. And I'm answering your prayer this way. I'm going to allow you to live your life with dignity. And that began the day I walked through the door and heard Sandy Beach talk about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks. God bless you.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Funny because the tie-in to our next speaker, when Bill got on the bus to go over to PI, the guy that was running PI was Keith Lewis, who was a remarkable member of AA, another Marine, and who passed away a while ago, and we had a wonderful memorial service there in Tampa, and it's nice to remember him tonight, that we're mentioning Scott and all of that. And our next speaker happens to be one of Keith's closest friends and admirers and supporter and all those things. And he has a remarkable spiritual message. His story is inspirational to me very much. And he's also another Marine. So you guys really got stuck tonight. And I know you're going to enjoy listening to Dick Anderson from Atlanta, Georgia. Come on.
My name is Dick Anderson. I am alcoholic.
Amen.
And we stopped and visited with Julia Lewis. For those of you who knew Keith, he died November 15th, a year ago. And I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. But we stopped. My wife, Barbara, is with Julia this weekend. And I got, during our silence period, I had to break the silence for a couple of minutes because I got a Black Mary message from you to the hospital, and she had passed out in church. And so I need to ask everybody right now before we start. We know there's a power that brought us all here, and if we can just stop for a minute in your own way, ask for healing for Keith Lewis's wife, for Julia. Thank you, God. When we were sitting outside a few minutes ago, it occurred to me that now somebody in here today was talking about he's involved in nanotechnology, and there's nanotechnology and nanotechnology and all these achievements that we've had. But us sitting around that fire, looking up at that beautiful sky and the moon that was there, and sitting there thinking about our relationship with God is no more advanced now than it was 2,000 years ago or 6,000 years ago. And I think that's exactly what they were doing many, many, many years ago. That we don't know any more about God now than we did 6,000 years ago with all of the achievements that we've got. And we sat there and I just started crying, which is not unusual for me anyway, but I just started crying because I was thinking about how much God loves his children. And that's really, when it comes down to it, regardless of how many planes you can fly and how many businesses you can build, that's what we're here for. We're God's children, and he loves us, and he takes care of us. I was looking for a connection with God my whole life. I might not have been able to verbalize it, but I felt absolutely like there was something missing in my life, and that's really all I was looking for. I did not fit into my family. I come from a family of honor, and I've told this story before where I've just mentioned a few things, and I can prove it because I'm going to read three things out of the history books. First of all, my little sister is a bird colonel. Her brother's a bird colonel. We've got six of the grandchildren that are all in the military, Marines or Green Berets. This is my dad, who was a B-25 pilot during World War II. Intense anti-aircraft. This is one of the lighter commendations he got. It was a DFC that he got because he also got the Army Cross, which is like next to the Medal of Honor. But this is just one of his distinguished flying crosses. It says, intense anti-aircraft fire heavily damaged his airplane, courageously maintaining his crippled plane on course in the face of this strong resistance, which further damaged his B-25s. Lieutenant Anderson enabled his bombardier to release his bombs with devastating effect on this vital bridge. En route to base, the bomber suddenly burst into flames. Immediately ordering the stricken plane abandoned, Lieutenant Anderson determinedly remained at the controls until all crew members had parachuted safely and escaped with his own life just before the B-25 exploded in midair. That's not the biggest thing that he did. This is the first one of our Andersons. This is Richard Heron Anderson. I'm Dick. I'm Richard Jefferson Anderson. And this is, Richard Chloe Anderson was born in Hanover County, Virginia, died near Louisville, Kentucky. As captain in the 5th Virginia Continentals, he led the advance of the Americans at the Battle of Trenton, 24th December 1776, crossing the Delaware River in the first boat and driving the Hessians outpost several hours before the main attack was delivered. If you're derived from any Hessians, I apologize. But this is in the Continental Army. This is the great-great-grandfather I'm named for, who was General Dick Anderson under Robert E. Lee. And I'll read you what it says. Richard Heron Anderson, grandson of Richard Chloe Anderson, was a career U.S. Army officer fighting with distinction in the Mexican-American War and also served as a Confederate general during the American Civil War at Gettysburg under Robert E. Lee. Anderson was also noted for his humility. So from the very beginning, I did not fit into my family. I was not part of the family. I didn't feel like I fit, and they were humble. They weren't drinking at the VFW. As far as I know, I'm the first alcoholic of record in our family. I'm the first one that got drunk when I was in ROTC and went in. I was a staff sergeant. So I was separated from man. I was separated from family. Now, I had my first spiritual experience. I love pictures, moving pictures, and that's what I do for a living. And I had my first spiritual experience when I went to the drive-in with my mom and dad in 1956, and we went to see this movie, and I had seen black and white on TV, but I'd never seen color, and this was in Technicolor. And it was a movie. The big book says lack of power is our dilemma. This is a movie that had the kind of power that I knew that's what I wanted. It was called The Ten Commandments. And it was on this big screen in color with 120 feet wide. And up there, Charlton Heston would just take this staff. He was Moses in this film. And he would take it to one side and the wind would blow through his hair. And suddenly the Red Sea would part. And I made two decisions that night. One, that whatever that business was, I wanted to be around that business. And God was listening to me. Even when I can't hear anything, God has been listening to me. That's one of the things I've learned in AA. And that's what I do for a living. But the second thing was, I wanted to be on God's side because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so... So the next day at Linda Baptist Church, I went down the aisle and I got dipped and dunked. They were playing I Surrender All, and I gave my all. The most emotional, and I can tell you that this was a very emotional, I really meant this. I gave everything I had to God. But I did like some new people come into AA and they don't get a sponsor and they don't do anything to change and they're just coming to the meetings, and that's what I was doing. I didn't have a sponsor, and because I was disconnected from my family and felt like if they knew that I wasn't like them, I wasn't a hero, that I wouldn't be able to fit in. And so I couldn't tell my family, and I couldn't tell anybody at church, and nothing changed. And after a few days or weeks or whatever it was, I was still the same scared little Baptist Boy Scout, and so I felt like God didn't want me. I didn't fit in my family, and now I felt like God didn't want me. And I did all the things I was supposed to on the outside. I complied. I was a good actor. I'm a fast study and a good actor, but a slow learner. And so that's the way I felt. And my next spiritual experience, I was 14 years old, and this buddy David got us a six-pack of beer and a half a pint of gin, and I drank the beer and he drank the gin. And I, for the first time in my life, everything I had been looking for, I felt like I was tall, I felt like I was an adult, I felt like all that fear that I had, the fact that I didn't fit in, and from the beginning I was not a stay-at-home drunk, I was a go-to-town drunk, and going to town means when you're 14 means hitchhiking. In Louisville, Kentucky, the place to hitchhike at that time of night was a place called the White Castle, and I don't know whether they have any around here, but they're kind of like, they have crystals down here, I think, and a White Castle is kind of like of a low-end crystal. Anyway, it's a place where you go when you're drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning, get one of those little hamburgers with all the onions on it, which seemed like a good idea to get a dozen of them when you're drunk at three. But so that's where we were. And at midnight, my buddy Dave was not having the same spiritual experience I was having, and I watched a lot of TV, and I had never had a cup of coffee either, but I had seen in Perry Mason where if you have too much to drink, you have some coffee and it sobers you up so you can talk to the police. So I ordered some coffee for my buddy David, and he didn't have the effect that I thought he was going to have, and he threw up down the stainless steel counter. And it turns out if you're looking for Louisville City policemen at midnight in Louisville, the best place to find them is at the White Castle. So they came down and said, "What's the matter with your friend?" Now, I would have been scared to death to talk to these guys before, and especially if they told my dad or anything else. But I was absolutely, I didn't have the staff, but other than that, I was feeling pretty Moses-less. And I just said, he's had a little bit too much to drink. How old is he? 14. How old are you? 14. So I was in Louisville City Jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. Between that time and the time that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was arrested 22 times. I was only arrested once for drunk driving. I was arrested, and I was not arrested for stealing anything, 21 times for defiance. And this became an adventure. I felt acceptance whenever I was drinking with all that I had to pay for this. And I got kicked out of that house because that's not the kind of family they were. And I was living in high school with some other kids in an apartment. And I got arrested 6 times my senior year in high school. I was a smart kid and could have gone, just barely made it out of school because of the... because of my behavior. I got arrested at my senior prom for two counts of assault on a battery on a police officer. And at the same time, we have senior prom in Louisville. We have some other event called the Kentucky Derby. And up until now, my parents didn't know where I was because I'd been gone living with these other kids. And they got to see me where I was the next morning because on ABC, NBC, and CBS, the next morning, they had arrested seven Black Panthers who were in Louisville, Kentucky to disrupt the Kentucky Derby. I thought I knew all about race relations because I went to school with two Black people. And it was they put me in a cell with seven Black Panthers. So the next morning on NBC, ABC, and CBS, it was the seven of them and me in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket coming out for arraignment. It didn't matter. The only bad times I had during this time were when I was sober. When I was drinking, I felt connected. The fear was gone. I felt like I thought I was supposed to feel with God. I thought I felt acceptance. I felt love. I had this adventure. The other kids didn't get to go hang out with the Panthers. And all of that. I go to college. I knew I wasn't going to last long. I enlisted, and I went to Vietnam. And I came back. It didn't take that long, but I was drinking daily. I was a daily drinker and then a binge drinker on top of it. So I drank all around the clock, but I would go on binges on top of it, if that makes any sense. So I was good at what I did. I was a writer, producer. I have done, back in those days, I was working my best job that I got. I'd get fired from one job and go to another, but the last job that I had, I was working for an agency in New York City. And working for Coca-Cola, I did the Mean Joe Green Spot, the commercial that you see that, you know, with the football player and all that. So this job only required me to work for about an hour a day or 2 hours a day. I just had to do something creative, and then the rest of the time I could act like I was, you know, out in the middle of some kind of production meeting or something. I didn't have to do much, and I ended up crashing and burning. I was in a studio in New York. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning. I was doing that music, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing in Perfect Harmony, and I couldn't talk. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I hadn't had enough to drink. So I ended up reaching the bottom. Within a couple of years, I was sleeping on a bathroom floor. I had not paid my rent, so I couldn't tell them that there was water in the bedroom. I slept on the bathroom floor. I had a small black and white TV I watched in there. I was bleeding from the stomach. I had lost my ability to control my kidneys or bowels. I had, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had enough brain damage. It took me about a year and a half to learn how to read. And I was 27 when I got here. And I was being evicted from that apartment. They had given me a bunch of severance pay when they fired me from that job. And I was being evicted from that apartment, and I had the first actual prayer that I'd said in a long, long time. I went up to a liquor store, and they told me they asked me not to come back and said that we know the check's no good, and we don't want you to come in here anymore. And as humiliating as that was, and knowing that I was being evicted, knowing that they were locking me out the next day, the only thought that came to my mind was, oh, God, I hope He gives me that whiskey. And they did give me the whiskey. And I ended up walking back around the corner, and that bottle fell out of my hand and hit a concrete landing. And I had no place to go. And I had nothing to do. I was more hopeless and fearful in that moment than I ever had been, because I didn't have anything to fight back with. Like, it wasn't like a firefight. I didn't have a weapon. And I started screaming at God, and all my life, since God rejected me when I was a kid, or I thought God rejected me, I had been angry at God. I had blamed God for everything that went wrong in my life. And I started yelling, God, blanket, God, blanket, God, blanket. And something broke, and I said, God, help me. God, help me. God, help me. And I had a moment of peace, and there was that scene from a movie I'd seen 50 times called Days of Wine and Roses, where Jack Klugman walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw that, and I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner, and I didn't have a phone, and I didn't have a nickel or a dime, whatever it was at that point. And I called an operator, and an operator knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And um, There was a woman named Helen who was in the central office and just started working here in Atlanta, and she sent out, she answered the phone. A live person answered the phone. And she sent out a railroad man named Jim, who I don't even know where he is to this day. But from that day until now, I've not been without a man who was do everything within his power to help me stay sober. I went through DTs for 4 days, and I came out, and I still was scared. I had surrendered, and I had bottomed, but I didn't know where there was any hope, and I thought I'd never laugh again. And after the fourth day of DTs, they brought me out, and they played a tape. And the tape was of this Marine Corps pilot named Sandy, who, and I was sitting there in a robe and these little slippers. And if you remember his Drop the Rock tape, he had just done that, I think, a year before that. And this was in 77, so I think you'd just done that, Drop the Rock, in 76. And I started laughing and crying, and that's the way I was for the first year and a half. I got confused a lot because I'd laugh and cry, but I was alive. And so I surrendered. I started to relax, what Sandy was talking about. And then they took me out on a little van to a meeting and told me that I was going to hear somebody and I should try to listen. And it was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And he was the first outside speaker that I heard. And so I hear Sandy, and then I hear Chuck. And I believe that the same God that brought us here for this meeting, where we would all get to know each other, and we would all come seeking him, that same God was there to make sure that I listened, because I needed to hear Sandy, and I needed to hear Chuck. And I did everything that they were telling me to do, and I grew as much as I could. That first year and a half, a job kept me in AA, but after that, my brain started clicking, and I did these things that removed the separation between me and God. I started getting all the things out on my, it was like my fourth, fifth step that I did, where I finally got out the fact that I was angry at everybody, I was angry at God, and so forth. And I got all that out, and I got into the amends, and this is where the separation started to fade away. I start making amends. I went back to that Linda Baptist Church, and I'd been calling them hypocrites for a long, long time. And I got down on a Sunday night and said, I want to apologize. I've been calling you hypocrites for a long time. And I know that that was my way of looking at this, and I want to apologize, and I also want to be here and make amends by joining the church or being part of the church for a couple of years so I can do something. And two things happened. One, I'd already found unconditional love in AA. Now I found unconditional acceptance and love in this church. Now, I don't spend a lot of time in that church or any church really at this point, but I felt my life started to open up, and I felt like God was not just in AA. It wasn't just an AA-oriented thing. The second thing that happened was I had been looking for a relationship because I was sober a couple, 3 years by now, and it wasn't going all that well. There was a girl who heard me apologize to that Baptist church that night, and she was not the kind of girl I was looking for. She was a seminary student and a good girl, and I was looking for a new dancer who needed some spiritual guidance. But because this is my experience, if I'm just doing a few simple things I'm supposed to be doing every day, God provides everything, big and small, that I need, and I don't have to do the work. That woman who heard me speak that night is my wife, and she's over at the hospital taking care of Julia right now. I had a lot more amends to make, and I made an amends to the final church that I had actually desecrated when I was in high school. I was so angry. And I went back in and didn't know who to apologize to, and there was nobody in the chapel. And ended up realizing I was there to forgive God. Every day I'd been asking God to keep me sober and thanking God at night. But I had a lot of hate and resentment still for God. And I got down on my knees and I started forgiving God, and I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had. We say it when we say the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, and one actuates the other. And I did this, and suddenly I felt like I didn't weigh anything, and everything had been taken off my back. And what I realized I felt was the way we're supposed to feel when we're at peace with God and man. I didn't have any conflict at that point. And all this extra burden was taken away from me. And things started to change very drastically in my life. And I was with a group of men that believed in going to an annual retreat to do like this, and it was at a contemplative order, a place called Gethsemane, a Trappist monastery up near Bardstown, Kentucky. And we went, I'm not Catholic, but we went there to do an annual house cleaning. And I went there, and I was ready to hear this, and I didn't know what God's will was. And this priest, this cocky Irish priest, gets up, and I don't know why the Catholic Church has all the priests around there were Irish. But anyway, he was a cocky Irish priest, and he stands up and he says, "You boys know what God's will is, don't you?" And none of us, at least, we didn't say anything. And he said, "God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can with what he gives you right this moment. If you're a son, be a good son. If you're a father, be a good father. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If God got you sober in AA, be a good member of AA. If you have a job that you love and you're good at it, do it honorably and serve others through that job until he gives you something else. If you have a job that you hate, do it honorably and love others until he gives you something else." And he said, "You're God's children. And it's not hard to figure out how he relates to you. Because if you guys had two boys and you gave both of them a little red wagon, and one of them took the wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy to all the other kids, but the other kid took the wagon and set it aside over here and said, 'I want a scooter,' who would you give more to?" And I had always been the one who, whatever you gave me that day, I set it aside because I wanted something else. And the light went on that if I just am here in this moment right now, accept what God gives me and do the very best I can with it, God will take care of everything else. And he'll give me everything I need. He gave me a wonderful wife and a soulmate just because I went to go make amends out of fear of sponsor. No noble cause. I just happened to be doing the right thing at the right time. I'm going to talk about something I don't normally, I've only mentioned this a couple of times. I had a real problem with lust. And being a kid that went to college in the 60s and, I was a musician for a while and a little loose, and I just had a real problem with lust. And for the first year and a half I was in the program, I was scared to death of everything. And then after my brain started working again, I got a little cocky and started sleeping around a little bit again. And I wasn't sure what to do. And I went to this church that I had rejoined, and I asked the minister, who was a real easygoing guy, and I said, "Would you pray with me? Because I really want to find out." The big book says we prayed and asked God to help shape our ideals. And I was in this room with this minister, and both of us were kneeling down, our eyes were closed, and suddenly it was like this vibration started that was bigger than the building, and there was a light in that room. And it was so powerful that I was afraid to open my eyes, and the minister had the same experience. And I said, "Do you know what that means?" He said, "I don't." And 3 days later, I was in the mall, and I was looking at a couple of cute women that were going by and thinking about them sexually. And suddenly it occurred to me that if I knew the father of any of the girls I took out when I was in college, I would respect them and treat them with honor, and I wouldn't take advantage of them. And that little bit of that, I had just touched a little bit of the power of this mighty God, and it was so awesome on that particular day. And that is the father of those children, because those women are children of God. And that changed the way, because I'm not very good with "don't do this and thou shalt not." That changed the way I looked at women, because they are God's children. And if I want to be God's son, then I have to let them be God's daughters. And if I'm going to respect, if I want respect, and if I want God to take care of me, and if I want to live with integrity, I've got to treat them the same way. And that changed the entire way. I don't share that very often. I think I've only shared it a couple times. But that's how God gave his message to me about how I deal with women. Almost everything that, I'm going to close in just a minute, almost everything that Sandy was talking about, for me, is acceptance. When I accept what is happening right now as God's will and I'm happy to do what God wants me to do, regardless of what it is, I stop working under my power and I start working under God's power. In 2005, we didn't have children. We weren't able to have children. We'd put our 18-year-old elk hound to sleep, and he had been named Booger Bear. He'd been to about 300 or 400 AA conferences all over the United States, traveled with us. And he was like a child, and we sat there crying, thinking that's the worst thing that can happen. We were the caretakers for Barbara's mom and dad, and they both died within 10 days of each other, unexpectedly, and we were their caretakers. And he had Alzheimer's, and she was starting to get some dementia, and she didn't want to be here without him. And we realized that. It was still painful, but we realized that. And within a few weeks, my mom died. And this was in 2005, and we went to Toronto. I've been to 6 internationals, and after we got back from there, I went to a physical, and they said, you have esophageal cancer. And esophageal cancer is about 98-99% fatal. And you need to get your affairs in order. And I could not tell Barbara. And because I could not tell Barbara, I could not tell you, because you don't gossip in AA. And so the only people that knew were my sponsor, Keith Lewis, my prayer partner, and a couple of medical people that were helping with this. And I was praying as hard as I could pray, and I was praying for healing. And we found a place that had devised a way to remove all your stuff in your chest, rebuild a whole upper digestive system, take the esophagus out and do all this. It was out at University of Southern California. And I tried to get out there, and I was supposed to go, and Clancy was helping me, and Lynn Wilder was helping me, and everybody, somebody sponsored somebody on the Board of Regents, they wouldn't take my Aetna insurance. And I was speaking in Key West, it was a Saturday night, and on Friday and Saturday before I spoke, I couldn't even talk. I was trying to pray, and I would wander all around in the wilderness because what kind of God would let me die because my insurance won't work at this hospital? And then I realized what I'm supposed to pray for again, and I'd gotten off base. I was praying to ask God to help me with my plan. Instead, I said, God, if it's my time to go, and you want me to go be with you, and I'm going home, then I accept that. And I wasn't really afraid because my original sponsor was a railroad man named Jack Sullivan from Louisville, and Jack had been diagnosed with 6 malignant brain tumors, and I had talked to him the day he got diagnosed, and I said, I don't hear any fear in your voice. And he said, if God is this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting on the other side. And the big book says we lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. And so I accepted that, and I got up on Saturday night, and I said, I don't know whether I'm going to be here a year from now, but I know that God loves me, and wherever I'm going to be fine, and my wife is going to be fine, because God's going to take care of both of us, and he loves both of us. We're his children. And whatever burden I was carrying was released because I had accepted what God was going to do. And on Monday morning, I got a phone call from USC, and they said, we still can't handle you, but our chief of surgery just went to Rochester, New York. And if you will call him, he may be able to help. And I can't even get my primary care provider to call me back, so I'm calling to see if I can get the chief of surgery at Strong Memorial in Rochester, New York, to call me back. And when I called up there, I got a phone call back within an hour. And it was the chief of surgery. And he said, we don't care about the insurance just coming up, because I just started a program and we need people. I want to teach the people how to do this procedure. So we go up there, and you know how we are. I'm thinking, well, this is too easy. So we get up there, and there must be a catch. This is not the best place to go. And we walk in, and for several days when I couldn't pray, A friend of mine said, just try any prayer you can remember from your childhood, because God's the one that's not confused. You contact with God. And I started saying the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And I said that over and over and over, and finally that's what broke me so I could surrender to God and just accept whatever he wanted. We walk into Strong Memorial Hospital, and as we walk in to the chapel, my wife and I go in there first, so we want to touch base. And we walk in there, and on a wall that's 30 feet high, in letters that are a foot and a half deep in gold, it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And we knew we were in the right place, and we walked out in the lobby and realized that this is Strong Memorial Hospital. And instead of me going out to USC, I'm at Strong Memorial Hospital, which was endowed by Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law. This is the same God that people were looking up to under the stars, around a fire, 6,000 years ago. The same God that brought us here has the same power to take care of every little detail. But ultimately, I don't think he saved my life because I'm a good guy. And I don't think he saved my life because people prayed for me. He saved my life because it was his will. Because last year we also lost Scott, and we lost Keith. And Keith was praying like crazy for me, because his best friend before me, a guy named Mike Way, died of cancer. And he didn't want to see me go that way. And we knew Keith had problems for 2 or 3 years, but we didn't know what. But I have never met a man who spent more time reading, studying, trying to determine how to please God than Keith Lewis. I just, Thursday night, was at his house, and he had probably 20 books there that were just on the great philosophers talking about God. And I'm going to close with this. I was in the room with Keith. I went to visit him 6 weeks. He had Lou Gehrig's disease. And I went to visit him 6 weeks before he passed. And this is what he did during the day. He could not talk. He could not eat. He choked. Lou Gehrig's is a debilitating disease. And what he did was he got up in the morning and he went to Mass and he prayed for people. And then he came back home and he made rosary beads. And if you remember his story, he made rosary beads with the right amount of beads. And he was making them Army colors, Marine Corps colors, Air Force colors, and Navy colors, and sending them to the troops over there. And then he would go back to the Adoration Chapel, which was open 24 hours a day, and he would pray for people between 11 and 12. And then he would go to lunch, and then he'd come back and he'd make rosary beads, and then he would go and pray for people between 4 and 5. 6 weeks before he died, I spent a week with him. And I have never prayed for people that much, and I've never done that much good work in a day for other people. Keith had determined that whatever it took, he was going to do what God was asking him to do. He loved God, and he wanted to be with God. And 6 weeks later, I was in the room, and the other night I had dinner with Julia, and with the Eucharistic minister who was in the room. Her name was Linda. And we recalled exactly what happened, because I wanted to make sure this wasn't in my mind. But Sandy was there, John Holmes, who's his current sponsor, was there, his little brother, Dumb Denny, was there, and his sister, Patty. And Sandy, John, Denny, and Patty all left at 11:30 on November 14th. And Julia asked me to stay, and we started praying. And in that room for the next hour, this tremendous spirit built. And Keith had been sitting there for 2 days with his rosary beads pointing to statues of Jesus and Mary. And if you didn't know Keith, he was very, very, very devoted, committed Catholic. And he would point. And he was letting us know that he wanted to do what God wanted him to do. He wanted God's will. He wanted to go home. And as he did that, that last hour, that room filled with this tremendous spirit. And I can't explain it any other way than the three of us were beaming at 12:30 a.m. when Keith gave his last breath. And it was as peaceful as the breath you gave yesterday. He just went... And we knew that his body had stopped working. And for a while, the spirit in that room was such that Julia, his wife, and me, his best friend, and this girl, Linda, who had learned to love both of them, could not stop smiling at each other. God the Father had come to wrap up his child and take him to this paradise that he promised. I believe that's where Scott is. And with that was what I was looking for all my life. And if I know that that's the worst that's going to happen to me, that God's going to take me to paradise, then what excuse do I have for not accomplishing what I need to accomplish while I'm here on earth? Just by being close to God and walking hand in hand with him. That's what we're here for this weekend. Thank you.